Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
ESNY.
Center field, where did Dusky arrive? This one is gone. A home run for Alex Rodriguez, and the Yankees take a 1-0 lead.
So we're diving right in, folks. Bleacher Creatures, episode number 150. The reason you heard that that quote right now, here in the booth with us, we have Ken Singleton. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Josh. Pleasure to be with you.
Now, Ken, I got to start off really quick. How long did it take you to get used to the sound of your own voice on podcasts? Because I still don't get used to it when I'm re-listening to these episodes. So I was interested now.
Yeah, that's a good question, because you don't really hear yourself the way you think you would, if you understand what I mean.
Absolutely.
I get replays of my voice and I'm saying, man, I sound like that. And but other people seem to like it. I guess that's what counts.
I mean, I remember the first time hearing you on the Yes Network. I think it was April 1st or April 3rd of 1997 out on the West Coast.
Oh, yeah.
And I just remember my mind being blown, because I was actually aware of you through a computer program I had where you could have the 79 Orioles play against the 61 Yankees or the 27 Yankees and the like. So, hi, like, it's Ken Singleton, and 11-year-old me is going, oh, I know that name, and I had no idea you were broadcasting. Uh-huh. A little deeper dive. Look at the names that you have gone into broadcasting with. And on the Montreal side, Dave Van Horn.
Yeah.
And then on the Yankees, it's a hit parade. Jim Cott, Bobby Mercer, Michael Kay. Like, all right, we'll do this right now. Who would you rather be stuck in traffic with, Michael Kay or John Flaherty?
I guess Michael, because he could tell more stories. You know, he's been around longer.
All right.
Although, you know, I'm kind of the one that got Flash into play-by-play because I told him, if you want to stick around for a number of years, you've got to learn this. And we were doing a game together in Tampa Bay, and I told him, you're going to do the third, fourth, and seventh innings. And he said, oh, I'm not sure I'm ready. I said, well, somebody's got to talk, and it's going to be you.
Very blunt.
Yeah, that's how he got started doing play-by-play. And Flash, I'm very proud of what he's done over the years. To think that I'm the one who got him started in play-by-play. Now, of course, he's a great analyst, being a catcher in his major league career. But former players who can do both are very rare indeed. And the fact that I got him started, I'm very proud of him.
Let's shift right into another younger protege of yours. Ryan Rucco has also done a great job on play-by-play with the Yankees. He's just a great guy all around. You really enjoyed working with him, didn't you?
Most definitely. You know, Ryan started out as our stats guy.
Yeah.
He was in the booth with us, and I could tell that he was going to go places, because he was always right on with his stats when he would hand them to us. And, I mean, he is probably – you know, he's everywhere. I mean, he's doing basketball. I think he does a little bit of boxing. He does women's basketball. He does Nets games for the Yes on the Yes Network.
Yeah.
And of course, he fills in for Michael Kay when Michael doesn't want to go on those West Coast trips. So, you know, that's – you hear Ryan Rucco everywhere. I'm very proud of him, too. I mean, these are young guys who are just sitting to my left in the booth, and they had aspirations of being broadcasters, and – you know, Ryan is one of the best around now.
Last one on the broadcasting end. How infectious is Paul O'Neill's energy in real life?
Paulie's something else, to be honest with you. I really enjoy working with him. David Cone. Coney is, gone on to bigger and better things. He's now doing games nationally. I think Paul really plays best to the Yankee audience because they love him. They love him as a player, and now they love him as, you know, his quirkiness as a broadcast. You never know what he's going to say. And, you know, you're thinking when you're working with, how are we going to get this back on track? You know, just how are we going to get back to the ball game here? And eventually we do. Paul knows his stuff. There's no doubt about it. But he has a way of, you know, making light in the booth.
Especially on Old Timers Day, too, because I'm never going to forget this when Mariano Rivera got him with that cutter inside, fights it off, and you hear just Paul just go, I thought you weren't going to throw that, just like yelling at him running to first base. It's clear, like, the love for the game, when going, you've done this transition yourself, playing the broadcasting, yeah. The love for the game follows.
It does. To be honest with you, Josh, there's nothing like being a major league player. But, I mean, I did it for 15 years, and I played for some very good teams and got to a couple of World Series and a few All-Star games. But being a broadcaster is kind of second best. It's a close second because it keeps you around the game. You have to do your homework for sure.
Yeah.
And I felt that it's kind of kept me younger over the years, or at least feeling younger than I actually am, because you're around all these young players and stars who are, you know, primetime athletes, and then it makes you want to stay in shape, to be honest with you. Yeah, I do my best to do so.
I must say, you look like you could call an entire season right now.
Oh, no, I don't think so. I did it for 37 years. You know, there were a couple of seasons where I played every game and when I was playing, and that's tough enough as it is. I think as you get older, you know, travel kind of wears on you. Other things become more important. You know, family becomes more important. You know, I have grandkids now and I like to be around them. To be honest with you, through modern technology. Now, I'm in Maryland right now, but we spend most of the winter in Florida. In fact, we'll be going back after the holidays. And my son can actually stream my grandson's basketball games. So with modern technology, you know, I don't feel like I'm missing all that much, because I could be sitting on the beach and watching his basketball game, or, you know, just coming off the golf course and watching a basketball game up from South Jersey and with my grandson scoring points and, you know, handing out dimes. You know, that's he's a good player.
You get on the golf course a lot these days?
Oh, my goodness. Well, now that I'm here in Maryland, it's too cold. But I'm in Florida. I'm playing at least three times a week. I've got several of my former teammates down there.
Oh, that's great.
Mike Torres, a pitcher, and Ross Grimsley, a former pitcher.
Yeah,
I've played quite a bit.
Whereabouts in Florida?
We live in a little town in between Clearwater and St. Pete Beach. Only 1,400 people. When I was doing Yankee games, of course, the Yankees trained in Tampa. It was only about a 35-minute drive. Well, during spring training and spring break, so it usually takes you 40 minutes to get over to Tampa from where we were. And during the season, when I went down to do games at Tropicana Field, Tropicana Field is only a half hour away. So it was a very strategically placed little town called North Reddington Beach. So,
I grew up in Naples. So
I'm
the area. So I grew up down there and went to high school, played a lot of baseball in that area. So
yeah, Naples is beautiful down that way. It's a little far for us to go to play golf, but very nice. Hopefully, they get through the Zian thing, and it wasn't too bad. Originally, it was headed directly for us.
Yeah.
And we live on a barrier island, and it turned with about a day and a half or 2 days ago. And I will tell you guys, there's a local legend around where we live. The next town over is Seminole, Florida.
Yeah.
And the original inhabitants were Seminole Indians. And all the people around where I live down there, they know that the local legend is that the Indians, the Seminole Indians, blessed the land so hurricanes would not hit it. And twice, we've been there 20 years in the wintertime mostly, and twice hurricanes have been coming straight for us, and both times they turned. And so people are thanking the Indians and going to the casinos a lot more.
Keeping with the Central Florida theme, my grandparents, so may they rest in peace, wintered in Sarasota for years.
Yeah, even closer. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, I just remember, like, one particular year, a spring break, went to see the Pirates play the Cardinals in Bradenton at McKechnie Field.
Yes.
Then drove to see the White Sox play the Phillies on St. Paddy's Day at Ed Smith Stadium. And then somewhere in between, got dinner at Shaner's and saw Shane Raleigh just slinging pizzas and beers all over the place.
Yeah, well, now Ed Smith Stadium in Sarasota is populated by Baltimore, the Orioles. Yeah. And of course, the Pirates have been in Bradenton, you know, maybe since Honus Wagner. So,
yeah.
They've been there a long time. And I can recall playing in both those stadiums from time to time in spring training.
There's a magic about spring training that's almost like minor league baseball. There's so few bells and whistles that you're actually just forced to sit and enjoy the game.
Yeah, you can't. I think the players are more relaxed. They have a tendency to sign more autographs.
Yeah.
Nothing's really serious as of yet. If you lose the game, it's no big deal. You're just kind of getting ready for the regular season to start. And Legends Field where the Yankees or Steinbrenner Field where the Yankees train. It's a beautiful facility. It's maybe one of the best in Florida, although all of them are very nice now. They're completely different than when I was playing. They were just minor league ballparks when I was playing, but now they're complexes where they have several diamonds, and you know, some teams even host their minor league teams there in barracks and dorms. The Yankee minor league state facility is just down the street from Steinbrenner Field.
Well, yeah. They've been pulling down there all those franchises because, you know, in the summer we would do summer leagues and we'd go to those, you know, outer facilities, all have the branding of like the Red Sox, the Yankees.
Yeah.
I think we went to the old Indians down in, was it Homestead? I think it was. And
yeah. Well, yeah, that's a long time ago, Alex.
They were like only used like, again, now they're like only used for these summer tournaments and high school leagues.
Uh-huh.
But like, yeah, you had the old branding on the walls and stuff. It was really like, as a kid growing up, it was always a cool experience getting to play where the Twins were, where the Red Sox were, JetBlue before they did the renovations. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's such a cool place to grow up as a baseball fan, and I imagine it's a cool place to be like when you've been in the game all your life and you know, you stick there and you get to enjoy it even more because like, yeah, it's, you step in the same batter's boxes as some of these major league players did during spring training. Like, uh-huh. I remember kind of having those moments like, wow, I'm stepping in the same box as Derek Jeter. You know, I was a Yankee fan growing up. Paul O'Neill was my favorite guy, but you know, yeah, it was always a cool time. And then once spring training comes around, you feel it in your bones, and it's that time of year.
Yeah, it's funny because when you're a player, you have that sense that time is getting close here. You know, during my time with Baltimore, we trained in Miami. Wow. And such a bad place to train, to be honest with you. you could sense you wanted to get out of the cold weather. I lived in Maryland during the winter in those days, and I was ready to go to spring training. I was ready to get it started. We, like I said, we had good teams in those days, well before your guys' time. It was the Yankees, Boston, and ourselves, Baltimore, going for it every single year. And it was like a three-way race every year. Great competition between those three franchises. During my 10 years in Baltimore, we won more games than any other team, more regular games. We won over 900 games in 10 years. So that shows you how good the franchise was. But, you know, we had to deal with the Yankees and the Red Sox every single year.
Go ahead.
It was great competition.
It was. You really had a life all over baseball. You're born in New York. You grew up in Mount Vernon, lived in, I believe it was Ralph Branca's house at one point. And your dad was a big Dodgers fan, but you were a Giants fan. Then you played for the Mets and broadcast for the Yankees. That's pretty much every New York baseball sport. So you got all your passport stamps.
Yeah, that's true. The reason my dad was a big Dodger fan because of Jackie Robinson, of course. Right. But I was a Giant fan because of Willie Mays. I mean, he was my favorite player. He could do everything. And then when I started playing, I actually got to play against Willie Mays and Hank Aaron, those guys, early in my career.
Yeah.
Talk about your baseball cards coming to life. I mean, just and not only coming to life, but doing damage to your team. but those guys, you know, well-deserved Hall of Famers. And, you know, playing against them and, you know, getting into All-Star games with them was pretty cool, to be honest with you. I did, like I said, there's nothing like being a major league player. Growing up in Mount Vernon, of course, it was a great town to grow up in. There's a lot of the schools were great. Yep. The recreational activities for the kids were fantastic. I'm not sure what it's like now, but that's the way it was back then. And the high school teams were good, Mount Vernon High School. I went on to college for a year at Hofstra University, and then the Mets drafted me number one. So my dad thought I was crazy for quitting school, but 3 years later, I was in the big leagues. So he didn't think I was so crazy then.
So you grew up in New York, went to Hofstra on Long Island, then you get drafted by the New York Mets, but then you go to the minors. And back then, I mean, Reggie Jackson talked about this in this book, how a lot of young players, particularly like younger black players, going to the South. That must have been like a big culture shock.
Yeah, in a way it was. I would say this. When I went away to play ball, my dad was from Alabama. And I can remember what he told me. He said that, remember, you're from New York City. You're just trying to get back here. You know, so 3 years later, I was back. To me, I felt that a lot of the heavy lifting was done before I got into pro ball. I mean, guys like Jackie Robinson and Larry Doby and, you know, Mays and Aaron, all those guys, they went through it more so than I did.
Doby your hitting coach in Montreal?
He was. And he was actually the man who taught me what type of hitter I should be. He told me that you can hit 300. And in those days, hitting 20 home runs was big. You know, you hit 20, you can hit 20 home runs. Of course, now everybody's going for him. I mean, 20 is like a shortstop now.
Yeah.
But he said that you can do both. If you rely on one more than the other one's going to suffer. So my first big year, of course, was in Montreal with Doby as my hitting coach. And he worked with me just about every day. I hit over 20 home runs. I hit 300 that year. I led the league in on-base percentage, which in those days was not such a big deal. It wasn't even a negotiating point on our point, on our part. Nowadays, you lead the league in on-base percentage, that's worth an extra five, maybe $10 million.
Exactly.
But in those days, didn't even bring it up. You know, the fact that I led the league in on-base percentage.
Pivoting back to the Mets, because you worked with the great Larry Doby in Montreal, and we'll talk about Gene Mock in a second too. But you debuted with the Mets like right after the Miracle Team, so you're in the clubhouse with Gil Hodges, with Tom Seaver.
Yeah.
With Don Glendening, as a rookie, that your baseball cards come to life, like you said.
Of course, as you said, the Mets were the reigning world champs. And I was in spring training with the Mets the year that I got called up. And I had a great spring. I think I hit three or four home runs and, you know, I hit very well. But they were the reigning world champs and their team was kind of set. So I was kind of the last guy cut. Sent to the minor leagues, and here I am packing up my bag and getting ready to go across town to the minor league camp, and I feel a tap on my shoulder, and I turn around, and it's Tom Seaver. And Tom says, kid, he says, you had a great spring. You know, we're just loaded here. We're the world champs. But he said, you get off to a good start in the minor leagues, you'll be back in the big leagues by June. June 24th, I was back in the big leagues. Yeah, I joined the Mets in Chicago, and as I was walking into the visiting clubhouse at Wrigley Field, I opened the door, and the first guy I saw was Tom Seaver, and he just looked at me and tipped his cap and said, "Welcome back, kid." And to see him first, the guy who sent me off and said, "You'll be back in June," that was something special.
What was something you learned from Hodges specifically?
He was sort of the strong, silent type. I didn't get off to a good start. I was 0 for my first 11 in the big leagues. Mm-hmm. I went 0-4 in Chicago my first day. Then I got to face Fergie Jenkins the next day. I went 0-4 again. Got to Montreal. We went to Montreal to continue the trip. I went 0-3. So I'm thinking, oh, man, I'm 0-1, but they're going to send me back to the minor leagues. Next time up, I got a base hit. My first big league hit was a single to center. And the next time up, I hit a home run. So now I've got a batting average in the big leagues. And the next day before the next game, Gil Hodges says to me, when you hit your first major league home run, you get to take the lineup card out to the dugout and paste it on the wall or tape it to the wall. And I felt like a million bucks when he said that to me.
Amazing.
Of course, nowadays with players making 40, you have to feel like 40 million bucks. But the fact is that he made me feel welcome that night. I think I got three more hits that day. And, you know, I was kind of on a hot streak, as I had been in AAA, to get called up to the big leagues.
You're talking about something that, as much utility as there is to the war stat, you're talking about the one thing that can't be measured, which is that human element. You said that you felt like $1 million. So if you're out there feeling good, you're going to have a little extra bounce in your step. And just from the endorphins, you're probably going to be a little more focused and play better. There's no number that can measure that, or formula or algorithm, whatever.
Yeah, you're right, Josh. As a young player, you're not really sure. You know, you're feeling your way through the league.
Yeah.
Your first time to some of these major cities. And, you know, I had been to Chicago before because my mom was from there, but I'd never played ball at Wrigley Field. And then just going around the country to San Francisco and L.A. I can remember my first time at Dodger Stadium. I just looked around and just said, man, this place is awesome. You know, you want to do well. I remember the first time I met Vin Scully, probably the greatest baseball broadcaster ever. I was taking batting practice at Dodger Stadium with the Mets. And once again, I feel a tap on my shoulder and I turn around and it's Mr. Scully. And in his voice, which, you know, nobody can replicate, he said, "Welcome, young man, to the big leagues. I've heard a lot about you. You're from New York, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes, Mr. Scully, I am. In fact, when I was very young, I used to listen to you on the radio and watch you on TV when I was growing up, when I was about 4 or 5 years old. My dad was a big Dodger fan." So as the game progresses, I'm playing that night. And when I came up the bat, you know, in those days, the fans would bring their transistor radios to the game and listen to me while they're at the stadium. So I'm up there hitting it. Everybody starts laughing. I thought, did my pants fall down or something? And it was actually Vinny telling that story, and how he phrased it was, you know, he said, "I must be getting older because now kids who used to listen to me on radio and TV in New York are now playing in the big leagues." And of course, you know, I can imagine what he said when, you know, I was broadcasting Expos games, and you know, he's still going. And I've since retired. So from playing baseball. So I got to see Vin Scully on two different levels, as a player and as a broadcaster. And he was as a dynamic personality as you could meet. It's friendly and outgoing, and one of the nicest people you would ever want to meet in the game. And certainly he's going to be missed.
In keeping with you coming across so many baseball greats in your in your career, didn't you also play winter ball with Roberto Clemente?
Yeah, Josh, yeah, you're well prepared. Yeah, I played for Clemente in the winter of 1970 in Puerto Rico. He was my manager.
All right.
There's a couple of things I can recall about him. Frank Robinson was also managing in the winter league. They were both still playing.
Yeah.
But they were both getting ready for their post-playing careers, which was coming up pretty soon. They're both getting older. And I can guarantee you that Clemente would have been a very good manager if he hadn't been killed tragically.
In the majors, you mean?
Yes, in the majors. Yeah, wow. Yeah. You know, Frank went on to be manager of the year a couple of times.
Yeah.
But Clemente could have done the same thing. When I first got to winter ball, Clemente called me in his office the first day. And I'm thinking, I just got here. I can't be in trouble. So he called me in and he asked me, what do you want to get out of winter ball? And I said, first of all, I want to get experience. Our whole team was made up of young major leaguers, mostly Pirates, because of Clemente.
Okay.
We had people like Al Oliver and Dave Cash and Ken Brett and Tim Foley was my team, Mike Jorgensen. Just all these. Nowadays, you don't see that anymore. Big leaguers make so much money, they don't need to play winter ball anymore.
So quick note about Al Oliver. I will wave the flag till the day I die that he belongs to the Hall of Fame.
Great hitter. I think he's got almost like 2,800 hits. So
I think he's got over 2,800 hits.
Yeah, maybe more than that. Great hitter. good teammate. I used to hate it when he came up when I was playing against him in big league games. Yeah. But anyway, getting back to Clemente, he asked me, what do you want to get out of winter ball? And I said to him, well, I want to get experience. So next spring, I make sure I make the Mets. And I also want to hit 300. And he looked at me and he said, don't worry, you'll make the Mets. And then he said, why would you say you want to hit 300? He says, why don't you say you want to hit 320? That way, if you don't make it and hit 309, you know, that's still pretty darn good. He said, if you say 300, you hit 295. That's not 300.
So, Alec is a former hitting coach, and he's just loving every second of this.
Yep. Those words rang very true with me for the rest of my career. But the kicker to the story is we get down to the last game of the regular season. We're playing in Arecibo, Puerto Rico, and I'm hitting 299. And going into the last game, I needed to go 1-for-2 to get the 300. I made an out my first time up. The next time up, I hit a home run.
All right.
And as I'm coming back to the dugout, remember, the game's still going on. He looks at me and says, you're hitting 300, aren't you? I didn't know he knew. He knew what I was hitting. And he looked at me and he says, you're out of the game. That's it. And there was only like three players hit 300 in that winter ball that year. And I was one of them primarily because he knew I had to go 1-for-2. I didn't know he knew that. Wow. And surprised, he took me out of the game and just said, and that's not the only time that happened to me. That happened to me in the big leagues once. The last day of the season, I was hitting 299. And Earl Weaver said to me, he says, he didn't say if you go 1-for-2. He said, when you go 1-for-2. When you get your 1-for-2 and your first two at bats, I'm taking you out of the game. I got to hit my first time up. And when I went back, went to turn around, go back to first base, there was a pinch runner coming in. I was out of the game. And I hit 300 my first year with the Orioles. And I had just been traded to the Orioles that year, along with Mike Torres, who's my good guy.
Let's actually talk about that, because you found your footing in Montreal. You've been through the ringer. You had an allergic reaction to the uniform one time. But then you're playing there for Gene Mock, who's got very soft-spoken, has more of a player's manager reputation. And then, Alec, play Sound Cue 2.
No, I got to pull that one up.
Yeah, we've been looking forward to this all show.
Very famous. We've all heard it before.
Hit play.
We go.
That's the only reason. And you'll have your chance tomorrow. You got it as quick as you can.
What is wrong with you?
You ain't no good.
No, you aren't either.
Yeah, you
aren't
either. You ain't no good.
You're no fucking good either.
Your ass will never have our game
tonight. I hope you. I would have liked you.
Yeah, what do I like? What are you doing here now?
Well, why don't you call the league office and ask him?
Yeah, I will.
All right.
So, Ken, you're going to play for Earl Weaver. You had to be intimidated going to play for him.
Kinda, you know, but that what you just played is a classic. But at least once a week. I mean, he got thrown out of more games than any American League manager in history.
And, I'd like to talk about that game in particular. It's because I actually looked up the date. So it's mid-September, 1980. You're in a pennant race with I think that would have been the Yankees that year, right? Did they win the East?
I believe they did.
Yeah, and so
they're second again.
what blows my mind is that ejection happened in the first inning, I think before anybody was even on base.
Yes, Bill Haller, the umpire there, he had called a balk on Mike Flanagan.
Oh, wow.
That was Earl's argument, saying that he was just there for one reason, to screw us over. And and of course, Earl used stronger language than that. And the kicker is, and I found this out years later, Earl argued for about 10 or 15 minutes. I mean, he kept going back and thrown out of the game. So as he's leaving the game, he goes over to the mound and he looks at Mike and he says, did you balk? And Mike, well, maybe I did. And Earl said, well, screw you too.
That's great.
And he walked off. But the umpires hated Earl, and you know he hated them.
Yeah.
And but they were on their toes because he knew the rules. And like I said, I saw him get thrown out of. I saw him get thrown out of both games of a doubleheader. I just, you know, who's that happened to?
That just sounds like he had plans. He had to get to.
Well, yeah, it might have been the case too. But he was very intense during games.
Tell us about your first ever meeting with Earl Weaver.
He got me a few times. He yelled at me a few times. But if the first pitch of the game he thought was a strike and the umpire called it a ball, he'd start yelling right away. Is it going to be like this all day? You know, he was there to win. That he was not there to be your friend or anybody's friend. He got paid to win games, and he knew it. And
Alec, it kind of sounds like you watching any Yankees game.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know what I tell Yankee fans who really get intense when they lose a game? I tell them, look, you're not going to win every game. You just got to win most of them. Some of them are going to be tough losses. And fortunately for me, I was broadcasting Yankee games for 25 years. They had a winning record every year. I mean, no other team can say that. So I've been very fortunate playing for winning teams and broadcasting for winning teams.
That kind of leads to a question I wanted to ask. As you said, you broadcasted for winning teams. You played for winning teams, teams that did actually win it all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, compared to it was the 79 World Series you lost, and then the 83 that you won. And then from the booth, when you're observing those Yankee teams, mm-hmm. is there something to those World Series championship teams? Because we start to hear this dialogue about, oh, the playoffs are a crapshoot. And I don't fully believe in that. I think, you know, game 7 is a crapshoot for sure. But, you know, being so close and not winning it and then actually winning it and then watching the Yankees do the same during your broadcasting career, is there anything that you identified like, oh, this team has what it takes, or it's just you throw your hands up in the air?
That's a good question, Alex. And I will tell you this, in 79, we got ahead of the Pirates 3-1. And our team, I can tell you what happened. We got too overconfident. We thought, especially the way we picked up our third win, we rallied late in the game to win, come from behind and win. And everybody was in the clubhouse jumping around like it was all over. You know, we got them. They can't beat us now. Well, Willie Stargell would not let them lose. When we got to the World Series again 4 years later, and I will tell you, we had 15 of the same players on the team that were on the team in 79, which is very rare. And the reason why there were so many of the same players, because we had a good team and they believed in us. I mean, we had a winning record every year. They didn't want to, you know, we came close the years that we didn't quite make it. And we got to the World Series again in 83. We're up on the Phillies 3-1. Nobody was jumping around. Nobody was saying, we got this. Scott McGregor walked into the dugout after warming up and looked at everybody and just looked up and down the dugout and said, the World Series is over. And he was pitching that day, and he went out there and threw a shutout, and we won 5-0. And it wasn't the first time he did that. In 79 in the playoffs, we were playing the Angels, and we blew a game. We were ahead 2-0. In those days, the championship series was 3 out of 5. And we were up 2-0. We go out to Anaheim to play, and the Angels rallied, and we lost. You can imagine how the clubhouse was. It was so quiet because we blew a chance to go to the World Series. And so we're playing again the next day. It's quiet in the clubhouse after the game, as you can imagine. And Scott McGregor gets up in the middle of the clubhouse and says, I guarantee you we will win tomorrow. Now he's pitching. He threw a shutout, and we won 7-0. So years later, I said to Scott, I mean, we were on the golf course now. I said, Scotty, I said, you know, we had Palmer and Dennis Martinez and, you know, Mike Flanagan. We had some great pitchers, but none of them would have said what you said. None of them would have said. How could you say that? And he says, did you ever check my lifetime record against the Angels? And I said, no, not really. I think he said he was 21-4 against them in his career. Every time we played the Angels, Earl made sure that he would pitch because they couldn't hit him. And then I said, well, that doesn't say anything about the Phillies in 83. He says, "Oh, I just felt it that day. Felt it warming up that they weren't going to touch me." And he was right.
That's straight Andy Pettit energy from Scott McGregor. Yeah,
that's something that Andy Pettit would do. I mean, Andy's won more postseason games than anybody. Yeah. But I just think that I thought that Scott McGregor, although he didn't have the stuff that Palmer had, certainly, or Dennis Martinez or Flanagan, he just knew how to pitch, and he had great confidence in what he was doing, and he could really keep hitters off balance. His whole thing was, you know how they talk about soft contact now?
Yeah, sure.
One of the originators of soft contact, a lot of pop-ups and weak ground balls, and because guys are hitting the ball at the end of the bat or getting jammed, because he knew how to move the ball around and change speeds. And in that regard, he was a great pitcher. And like I said, when you throw shutouts to, you know, win a pennant and throw a shutout to win the World Series, I mean, those are big games. You know, and in those days, what was our World Series check that year? I think if you look at what the Astros got this year, they got $500,000 more than we did. Yeah, I think they got 560 something thousand. We got 64,000. It was a big deal.
Speaking of the business of baseball, the night we're recording this, the news came out today that the Yankees have reportedly offered Aaron Judge 8 years, $300 million. In your career, you were not only traded for Dave McNally, who was a big part of the reserve clause hearings.
Yeah.
But then with Baltimore, you got to experience free agency, like, really in its infancy.
Yeah.
So did you know from the start, I'm staying in Baltimore, or did other teams call?
There is probably only one team I would have left Baltimore for. Like I said, we were a good team.
Yeah.
We had young superstars on the team. I saw Eddie Murray break in. I saw Cal Ripken break in. Two guys that were on their way to the Hall of Fame. And it was kind of evident very early that they were going to be some of the best players in the league. I didn't want to leave Baltimore. I just wanted to be treated fairly. And I told my agent that. I said, am I one of the top 10% players in the league? And he said, yeah, sure you are. I said, well, make sure they pay me in the top 10%. And the Orioles are willing to do so. Years later, I found out working for the Yankees that George Steinbrenner tried to trade for me twice.
Wow.
To get me to the Yankees. Because I think the Yankees and Stick Michael in particular were well aware of what on-base percentage meant.
Yeah.
And that was kind of my game. And other teams really weren't into that. And I think Earl Weaver knew what it meant.
Earl Weaver absolutely knew what it meant.
Because my first year in Baltimore, he batted me leadoff, and I wasn't a leadoff hitter. And so both times that the Yankees, Steinbrenner wanted to get me back. First of all, he knew I was a New Yorker.
Sure.
But both times the Orioles said no. Now, fortunately for me, Baltimore is not that far from New York that my parents could come down and watch me play on weekends if they wanted to. Along with my aunt and uncle. But after my mom and dad retired, they moved down to Maryland to be near, and they lived 10 minutes away from us to be near their grandkids. My two oldest boys who are now grown men. But and it was my parents when I was growing up, they didn't get to see me play Little League much or Pony League, right, because they were working so hard.
Right.
But the payoff for them was at the end. They got to see my last three seasons in the big leagues, and they went to every home game. The ushers knew them. They would say, Mr. and Mrs. Singleton, you could move down, you know, closer if you want. Those seats are not going to be taken tonight. You know, and I'd come back. My mom and dad are sitting right behind the screen with the family sections up a little ways, and they were treated very well in Baltimore.
Did your dad also play baseball?
No, he didn't. My dad wasn't really that much of an athlete. At least he didn't talk much about it. You know, my brother was a big time track star. He was an All American, they went to Penn State, as his daughter, my niece, did, and as my daughter did, and they all graduated from Penn State. In fact, right over my shoulder here, that with the yellow frame, if you can see it,
that's
a picture of my daughter from our high school father daughter dance.
Oh,
now,
wow.
She went on to Penn State, graduated, got her degree in astronomy, and now she's out in Flagstaff, Arizona, working at the Lowell Observatory. So
wow.
She's anything you want to know about outer space and what's going on out there, you ask her. She can give you a pretty good answer.
Let's talk real fast about an old teammate of yours who hit more than 500 home runs to the moon. Uh-huh. 1 year in Baltimore with Reggie Jackson. What was that like?
Yeah, that was an experience, to be honest with you. First of all, Reggie didn't show up right away. I don't know if you guys knew this. He wanted more money. Oh, and the Orioles wouldn't give it to him to show up. So he showed up in May. I mean, we were already 1 month into and by that time, we were about seven games behind. And Reggie played well. I mean, I think he hit 20-something home runs and drove in 90-plus runs, missing a month of the season. I mean, he's a Hall of Fame player. There's no doubt. But that really hurt us when he didn't show up. And that was the first year of free agency. Yeah. And we kind of knew he was going to leave after the season. Now, years later, of course, Reggie's around the Yankees a lot. And, you know, me broadcasting the games. He and I became pretty good friends, and we talked. And he told me, he said, for $250,000 more, I would have stayed in Baltimore, which in this day and age is a pittance, but that's what it was back then.
Right.
And I began to think about it, because after Reggie left, yeah, I was the first Oriole to get a five-year contract. And and not only that, when my agent said, when I told him, tell him I want 5 years. And I'm thinking they're going to say no. And he came back the next day and said, they said, yeah. And then he said, how much money you want? I said, tell him I want this amount. You know, I thought I was shooting the moon. And he came back the next day. They said, yeah. And I said, man, I should ask for more. But anyway, my thinking was, if Reggie had signed with the team, there's no way they would have offered me that contract or that security. And by that time, I had one son, and my oldest son was born. So I'm thinking security now. I'm thinking, you got kids you got to take care of.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. You didn't live in Baltimore full time to start. Didn't you live out in California for a few years?
Yeah, I actually, my first year with the Orioles, I still lived in Montreal.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but that, you know, if you ever spend a winter in Montreal, you're ready to go somewhere else.
My bachelor party was actually on a weekend in December in Montreal when a 2-foot snowstorm was happening.
Goodness, it could snow like every day, yeah. You know, and during January, probably get to 30 below.
Oh,
so I remember Rick Dempsey calling me and asked me how I'm doing. And so I haven't been out of the house in a week, you know, and I said, what are you doing? He says, I'm watching a football game. He's watching the same game I'm watching, but he's sitting out on his back deck in California. So I told my wife at the time, I said, we're moving. She said, where we're going? She says, we're going somewhere nice. I said, how about California? She said, good.
And there you go.
And I lived one exit down the freeway from Dempsey. And we became golfing buddies along with Robin Yount and Rudy May. And Robin Yount was really a good golfer. I don't know if you guys knew, he almost quit baseball to play golf. Really? And he was that good.
Watching old footage of Robin Yount from, say, like the 80s when he was still an infielder. I said this earlier to an old colleague of mine. I said, watching Justin Verlander, I understand why guys like my dad and your dad, like are like that general generation, kind of was in awe of Tom Seaver and Steve Carlton. And I'm looking at Robin Yount, I got to figure, like, this guy had almost Mike Trout energy in his early days.
Yeah, well, first of all, he got to big leagues when he was 19 years old.
Exactly.
Yeah, the Brewers were just kind of coming into their own, looking for younger players. They got him. Molitor came shortly thereafter. And these two guys, of course, went on to the Hall of Fame. And both of them got over 3,000 hits. So I just seeing Robin Yount play, you could see that he was going to be a pretty good player. You know, by that time I was kind of into my, sixth, seventh year in the big leagues, something like that. And you watch the young players come in, you could see who's going to be pretty good. I remember seeing Trammell and Whitaker come in.
Oh, yeah.
I looked at them as, how are they going to beat us with these two little leaguers in the middle of the field? But, of course, they went on to become Trammell's a Hall of Famer. I think Whitaker should be. So I think the Veterans Committee will eventually put Lou Whitaker in the Hall of Fame. So
Speaking of playing alongside these young players, you mentioned them earlier, two of your Orioles teammates. You already mentioned Eddie Murray, probably one of the best switch hitters of all time. And then you mentioned Cal Ripken, who I can only imagine being a Baltimore Oriole when Cal Ripken Jr. walks into the room for the first time, because he's a shortstop, but he's 6'4", like built like a linebacker.
Yeah.
He just almost transcends the position.
Yeah, he was a big kid. I can recall 1981. This is before Cal got to the big leagues.
Right.
We had a strike that year, if you remember, that halted the season for about 60 days, 50-something days. And before the season got started again, everybody we were practicing at the Memorial Stadium, and Cal Sr. brought Cal down to the ballpark to work out with us. Well, Cal, the Orioles didn't know whether he was going to be a pitcher or a hitter at the time.
Okay.
And I was watching him hit. I mean, he's hitting rockets over the wall in left field. I'm saying, they want this kid to be a pitcher? There's no way. He should be playing wherever he plays. Now, he was a third baseman at the time, but we already had that. So Earl Weaver's thinking, you know what Earl's thinking? Maybe I'll move him to shortstop, and we could have two guys who hit 20-plus home runs on the left side of the infield, which is true. Now, eventually, the Orioles would trade Doug DeSense because, you know, he was a big union guy, and our team was a strong union team. And they got rid of both him and Mark Belanger, who are our union leaders. Most of the teams, in retribution to their clubs, moved their team leaders, union leaders, around. They got rid of them. They moved them around. And we lost to Sensei, who was a very good player. And Mark Belanger, who was maybe one of the best fielding shortstops ever. He won 8 gold gloves. And so they got rid of those two guys. And eventually, you know, Cal took over at short. But the Orioles had been looking for a third baseman for a long time since they left.
Did you, being in the Yankees booth during Derek Jeter's prime, did you see any similarities between himself and a young Cal Ripken, just in terms of how he commanded the room?
Well, I think one thing I saw right away, that they didn't make many mistakes. And if they did, they didn't make them again. They were both very well-schooled baseball players. Cal had a little more power than Jeter.
Right.
But, you know, I think Jeter hit 250-something home runs. Cal hit 400 home runs.
Yeah.
So there's a difference there. And as you said, Cal's a big guy. In fact, I will tell you this, Josh and Alex, that Cal Ripken is physically, he's the strongest player I played with. His physical strength was off the charts. I played basketball against him in the wintertime.
Oh,
and
wow.
You go after a rebound, you try and move him and push him, you couldn't do it. He would just hold his ground, and you couldn't move him. He had a great sense of balance. Very good basketball player, as most baseball players were. You know, actually, I went to Oxford on a basketball scholarship. So, and in those days, they allowed you to supplement your income by playing basketball against the schools, which was good for the Orioles because it gave them a presence in the community, and we raised money for the schools, and the players would get a little bit too. But all that ended when Mike Flanagan tore his Achilles tendon. The Orioles said,
no more
basketball.
And then 20 years later, Aaron Boone tore his ACL.
Exactly. So I could see, you know, in this day and age, why should you? They got so much more money invested in the players. I mean, each player now has his own personal trainer, so that they don't need to be playing basketball, and they don't need to be making extra money to trying to raise money for schools. They do it in other ways.
Let's do a deep dive here. This is from a Sports Illustrated article from 1977. Your former teammate, Brooks Robinson, said his career will be marred by the fact that he runs like me. Now, was Brooks always kind of a jokester when you arrived? Because he definitely seems like wizard on the field, kind of always had a smile off of it.
Well, of course, he's in the Hall of Fame, probably the greatest fielding third baseman ever. Yeah. By the time I got to the Orioles, Brooks was not hitting the way he used to, but he was certainly still the best fielding third baseman. And he was funny. I can remember the night that Sammy Stewart, right-hander, broke into the big leagues for us. And he struck out the first 7 White Sox that he faced first seven hitters he faced in the big leagues, he struck him out. And after the second inning, he comes back to the dugout, and Brooks says to him, "Sammy, don't be upset if you don't strike everybody out." And he went out and struck out the first guy from the next inning. And, Sammy was a hard thrower from North Carolina. He could really bring it up there. Of course, he settled into a relief role and was one of the better middle relievers in the game for a number of years. In fact, he was on our two World Series teams.
Those Orioles teams going, we'll say, from 1969 all the way up through 1983, if you look at those teams, there are some sneaky good players on there. We mentioned Jim Palmer. Don Baylor was there for a little bit. Al Bumbrey, Lee May, formerly of the Great Red Machine. It also just sounds like it was a good group of guys who, were it not for the Red Sox and Yankees also being highly competitive teams, you could have had almost like a 1960s Yankees energy about you.
It was great. There were great players on that team, like Palmer and Brooks, Cal and Eddie. Guys who were going to the Hall of Fame. We had a Hall of Fame manager. But the rest of the players, maybe not quite Hall of Famers, but really good players. And you mentioned some of them. Bumbrey's my best friend. We play a lot of golf together. Lee May, unfortunately, has passed away. But he's one of the funniest players I ever played with. And really, you know, his nickname was a big bopper. You know, we had pitchers like Tippy Martinez, Scott McGregor, and, Mike Flanagan. Really good pitchers. The backup Palmer in the rotation. Dennis Martinez. Still a good friend of mine. He lives in Florida, but he comes up and plays in my golf tournament in Maryland every June. We're still close, you know. That once you win a world championship with guys,
yeah,
that you have a bond for life. It's something that not every player gets to do. You think of those great Chicago Cub teams. With Ernie Banks and Santo and all that, they never won anything. You think of the Red Sox with Yastrzemski, never won a World Series. You know, and we got to do that. And that'll be with us forever. As we get older, next year will be the 40th anniversary of us winning the World Series. I'm sure the Orioles will do something to commemorate that. I don't know how many other guys that they'll bring back, but it seems like every time they have a reunion, the fewer guys are back. You know, the guys pass on. It makes it special. And unfortunately for Oriole fans, we're the last Oriole team to win the World Series. And it's been a long time. I mean, 40 years is a long, long time. And of course, nowadays, there's you might make the playoffs, which, you know, might demolicate some of the fans. They might feel, okay, we made the playoffs. We didn't win it all. But, you know, a team like the Yankees, they make the playoffs every year. I was there 25 years. I think they made the playoffs 22 times.
Yeah.
But unless you win the World Series, Yankee fans, that's not good enough. Mm-hmm. And other teams, it might be good enough we made the playoffs, but not New York.
That 1983 team, that was, like you said, a bunch of the guys left over from 1979, but there's that one key difference. Instead of Earl Weaver in the big chair, it's Joe Altobelli. Like, what? How is he different from the literal human spark plug that is Earl Weaver?
It was very, very different. Joe knew he had inherited Earl's team, and it was more or less a veteran team. We all kind of knew this was going to be our last shot at winning the World Series, and we did it.
Now, remind me, had Earl retired willingly?
Yeah, the year before.
I know he came back.
Yeah, well, that was after we were all gone. And I've heard over the years that one reason he didn't come back until after we were all gone, he didn't want to be the one to tell Jim Palmer that was it, you know. Mm-hmm. And he had left before Jim retired or was let go by the Orioles and the rest of us, for that matter. When he came back, it was a totally different team. It was so different, in fact, that Eddie Murray was not happy with the guys they brought in. They had signed some free agents. Years later, he said these guys had no idea what it meant to be an Oriole. They were just there for the bucks, and you know they didn't win. They didn't know. Eddie he got so ticked off that eventually they traded him. But they brought him back too, and he had his 500th home run in an Oriole uniform. Joe Altobelli was quiet. He Mike Flanagan used to say the ship is steering itself. Because Joe would just, he would write the lineup down and then let us go out and play. And we were on our way to win a World Series. So it wasn't much for him to do except write the names down. Now, I'm not taking away any credit from him because in a way we wanted to prove the real, we could win without him. And we did. And that was a fun year, but I knew I was getting older. Some of the other guys were getting older. And the next year was my worst year in the big leagues. And I knew it was my last year. I didn't want to play anymore after that. So I just...
Now, did you know you wanted to go into broadcasting straight away?
Not really, but I will tell you this. I was getting kind of prepared for it. In Baltimore, every weekend, I had a radio pregame show on the Orioles Network that I would interview one of the players along with one of the broadcasters. Tom Marr was the radio broadcaster, and he kind of produced the whole thing. But I was the guy who did the interview. Then in the off season, if we didn't make the playoffs, one of the local TV stations would bring me in, and during the newscast, sportscast, they would ask me questions about who I thought was going to win the World Series or win the playoffs. And the first thing I would say to the fans who are watching in Baltimore, I said, don't bet the house on what I say. A lot of things can happen in the playoffs. So I was no stranger to being on camera. But it's different when you're doing the games. And when I finally got out, the very next year I was in the booth. The very next year, Tony Kubek asked me if I wanted to do 20 Toronto Blue Jay games, ones that he couldn't do because of conflicts with NBC, you know, his game of the week.
Yeah.
So I said, sure, I'll try it. But my agent told them, he said, look, we're going to do this right. I mean, he's been on camera before. But we're going to do this right. We're going to go to spring training, do some games in spring training. And I did some Blue Jay games. And a week before the regular season started, the Montreal Expos signed on to the TSN network, the sports network in Canada.
Yep.
They came back to me and said, instead of doing 20 games, how about doing 80 games? You'll do the 20 Blue Jay games, but you'll also do 60 Montreal games. So I said, sure. I asked my wife, I said, what do you think? She said, are they going to pay you? Yeah. I said, they're going to pay me. Of course. 60 games more money. I said, yeah. She said, go ahead. So, about 3 years into that, the Expos came to me and said, we really like your work on TV. We'd like you to do every game. And I said, every game's not on TV. I mean, some of the English games are on radio. I said, we want you to do the games on radio as well as TV. So I got the work. You mentioned Dave Van Horn. I work with Dave, who's a Hall of Famer.
Yep.
I was a Hall of Famer. And I worked on radio with him. And he said, look, you got to do play-by-play. You got it on radio. Now, I hadn't done it before. He said, you're going to do the third, the fourth, and the seventh innings. So I did them, you know, and went from there. That's how I learned play-by-play.
And then you brought that full circle back to Flash.
Yeah, I brought it back to Flash, and I brought it with that ability to do that to New York 12 years later when I came to do the Yankee games. And like I said, not many players at that time did both or could do both.
Right.
And the people at the MSG Network realized that, and they thought I'd be a good fit with Jim Cott. And I will tell you this, working with Jim Cott was a sheer pleasure. He was a lot of fun. I think people in New York liked the fact that he was a pitcher and I was a hitter. And, you know, we always had that little clash there, you know, that little spark in between us that the fans could recognize, but we were very respectful of each other. Like, you know, he'd say that pitcher should have been a strike. And I said, you pitchers win everything, you know.
I feel like we've seen that recently with, like, Paulie and Tony and
yeah, and exactly.
And you're absolutely right. It is such a great entertainment.
Yeah.
Would you say that you were more nervous for broadcasting, like your broadcasting debut, as opposed to your professional debut, or vice versa?
Ooh, that's a great question. I will tell you that my first time up in the big leagues, I could almost feel my knees knocking.
Oh, wow.
I just wanted to hit the ball. I didn't care where it went, just wanted to hit it. I grounded out to second, and you know, I was kind of happy I hit the ball. But then I knew I was going to have to produce after that. And it's the same thing with broadcasting. I think you realize there's a lot of people out there that you can't see, and they're listening or watching. And some of the best advice I ever got was just make believe you're talking. When you're looking into the camera, make believe you're talking to, you know, one of your relatives or one of your friends, and that'll make you relax a little bit. You know, after 37 years of broadcasting, you got to be prepared. Number one, you got to do your homework. And when you work with somebody like Michael Kay, you figure if you don't know it, he knows it. And that way you can make the broadcast flow. Michael's a lot of fun to work with. I've had some great broadcast partners. I mean, and if one of the main things that every broadcast partner should do for your partner is to listen to what he says, because that makes the broadcast flow. And if you're talking about one thing, he's talking about something else, and it just clashing, you know, and fans want that flow. You want fans to not get up out of their seats to go to the bathroom if you can. You want them to sit there. Oh, we don't want to miss these guys, what they're saying, whether it's fun stuff. The toughest games are the ones where either Yankees are winning 14-1 or the other team's winning 14-1. Because you got to keep them interested, you know. You got to keep them from turning off the TV because the Yankees, this game's in the bag, or they'll never come back.
You know? I remember when I was in high school, like watching one because I played high school baseball.
So did I.
I played high school baseball. I was also a switch hitter, more like a contact guy. Okay. And I just remember watching one particular game that you were broadcasting when I was in high school. You were talking about the art of arguing with an umpire and not getting kicked out. How if there's a pitch you don't like, just kind of step back and go, that was not a strike. He does not need help. And just to have that very subtle, almost passive aggressive diss of the umpire where, you know, like pitch comes in, it's out of the zone, called a strike. That was not a strike. Okay. It's almost kind of needles at the umpire. It's like, that wasn't a strike. We both know it.
Yeah. Well, first of all, while you're saying that, you're not looking at him.
oh, yeah.
Because, you know, if you look at him and you say something right away, the fans are attuned that you're mad with the umpire right away. You want the umpire to know you're not happy, but you want to say it in a way that, you know, you're facing Nolan Ryan. He does not need any help. You know, just, you know, This guy's throwing 100 miles an hour. You know, he does not need any help up here, but you giving him a pitch 2 inches off the
outside. He's not only throwing 100 miles per hour, chances are one of those 100 mile per hour pitches, because people don't realize Nolan Ryan walked everybody. That pitch is probably coming for your head at some point.
Yeah. Josh, I will tell you, he was the most uncomfortable at bat of any pitcher I ever faced in the big leagues. Now, I still don't know. I hit 300 against Nolan.
Yeah.
12 for 40, but with 16 strikeouts. So the thing about it, I didn't feel bad striking out against him because he struck everybody out. You understand? Either struck you out, walked you, or maybe you could get a hit. So I never hit a home run off him. But he had trouble beating the Orioles because he walked a lot of people. And we had a team that seemed to come up with big hits. I can remember we had two guys who hit him pretty good. One was Mark Belanger, who didn't really hit anybody else but him.
Yeah.
And another guy was an outfielder named Pat Kelly, who had some power. Now, I can remember one night we're facing Nolan in Baltimore. We're losing 3-0. And he's got like 14 strikeouts. It's the eighth inning. And I'm not the next hitter, but I'm the next hitter after. I'm in the dugout sitting next to Earl. He said, Earl, he's throwing 300 miles an hour. I mean, he's really pumping it tonight. So meanwhile, somebody made an error. The bases were loaded and Kelly's up. Somebody made an error. Nolan walked two guys and we had the bases loaded and Kelly's up. And Earl looked at me and he said, we got him right where we want him. And I'm thinking, what? Kelly hit the next pitch for a grand slam. And Earl looked at me and winked because he knew Kelly could hit him. And we won 4-3. You could see the steam coming out of Nolan's ears on the mound. He was so ticked off.
Like, and, if I may flip the script, I remember going with my dad to a Yankees Diamondbacks game in 2002. Randy Johnson's on the mound, and Johnson, he tries to get cute with the strike zone, and he's walking guys. And then I remember, I'm pretty sure it was either Shane Spencer or Robin Ventura came up and just launched a grand slam off of him in the eighth inning.
My money would be on Shane Spencer because he's a right-handed hitter. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Ventura drew the walk, and then Shane Spencer hit the home run.
Yeah, well, stuff happens to even the best pitchers, you know. That makes it more amazing that Jim Palmer never gave up a grand slam. Never.
Palmer never gave up a grand slam.
He told me he walked a few with the bases loaded, but he wasn't giving up a grand slam. So he never did.
I've always been fascinated by him because Jim Palmer, my first memory of him is the old Money Store commercials he did in the 90s. So he's just got this big old smile. He's like, "Hi, I'm Jim Palmer." He's like almost kind of like Steve Garvey in a way. But then you look up, oh no, like this guy was one of the best pitchers of his time, probably the best for a few years.
Well, before your time, he was selling jockey underwear. I don't know if you remember those commercials.
No, I do not.
He did mostly ads in magazines, he'd be standing there in his jockey underwear and selling jockey underwear. And he was a good looking guy, and he had a little diva quality to him, but he was our meal ticket, you know. He won 20 games 8 times in his career.
Yeah.
So I remember Ivan Nova, the pitcher for the Yankees?
Oh, yeah.
I introduced him to Palmer one night. Nova had no idea who Palmer was, right? I said, I used to play with this guy. He was my teammate, Jim Palmer. This is Ivan Nova. Nova said, yeah, nice to meet you. You know, I said, Palmer was a pitcher. Nova said, yeah, okay. And I said, he won 20. And Nova kind of perked up a little bit. I said, he won 28 times. Nova, woo. Then I said, Hall of Fame. Nova said, nice to meet you.
All right. We're going to close this out with something of a baseball lightning round. All right, Ken Singleton. Oh, actually, before we do that, first off, since Alec and I are young guns, describe the old Memorial Stadium for us.
I thought it was a pitcher's park. To be honest with you, the gaps were very deep.
Yeah, it looked very big.
Full hitter, so to speak. Most of my home runs went to the gaps. But it was very close down the lines. It was 309 down each line. Oh, sort of like a horseshoe. And the hit went out in right center, left center, or straightaway center. You really had to get into it. But down the lines, I mean, you could barely hit it, and it's going out of the ballpark. So guys like Palmer and Flanagan, they had a way of getting people to hit the ball to center field. And when I first got to Baltimore, Paul Blair was playing center. You know, he won about 8 or 9 gold gloves. Yep. And then after Blair left, Al Bunbury, one of the fastest guys I ever played with, he was playing center. You know, I tell people I made a good living playing right field, saying, Al, you got it. And, you know, he could cover a lot of ground. And, you know, I still joke with him about that on the golf course. So.
You said Nolan Ryan was your most uncomfortable at bat. Who was your most? Who did you love to face pitcher wise?
Pretty good pitcher, Dennis Eckersley.
All right.
There are certain guys that just throw your speed, and I think he knew it, and I knew it too. He knew that if he messed up a little bit, something was going to get hit pretty hard. I think I had more hits against him than any other pitcher. He used to throw sort of like 3/4 sidearm. And when you're on the other side, hitting left-handed, you get a good view of that stuff. And I can recall the Oriole record for consecutive hits is 10. And I have that record. I had 10 hits in a row, and it all started with a home run off Eckersley. I went 4-for-4 that day, 4-for-4 the next day, and then 2-for-2 the next day before I finally made an out. And Cedric Mullins had 9 hits in a row.
I remember that.
Yeah, the year before this year. And I was actually listening to that game driving in the car, and they're mentioning, oh, well, back in 1981, Ken had 10 hits in a row. Now, here's Cedric Mullins. He has 8 hits in a row. Oh, another base hit. He had 9 in a row. So he's coming up, and I'm thinking, should I be rooting for this guy to get this? Of course, he didn't get it. I think he flied out.
Yeah,
he did. Hit at 9. So one of my buddies said to me, one of my golfing buddies said, were you rooting for him to get that 10th hit? And I said to him, if you have a record for 40 years, don't you think it's worth keeping? he said, I think you're right. Yeah. So, you know, I wasn't really rooting for him, but I know how tough it is just to get 9 in a row, let alone 10.
Yeah.
The record is 12. So, and the ball I hit after I had gotten 10 was probably the hardest ball I hit of all those at bats. I hit a rocket, was it turned into a double play. That could have been an 11 straight hit. The pressure would have been on at next at bat.
Absolutely. Similar vein. All right. As a visiting ball player, favorite ballpark to visit as a player, least favorite ballpark to visit.
Okay. Can I have more than one?
Sure.
All right. My favorite place to hit was the Kingdome. It's the world's greatest
hitting ball. Yes. I love the Kingdome.
It was, well, the gaps were like 365.
Yeah.
Center field was pretty far. You could keep it away from center field. I think I hit 14 home runs in that place. And wow. Those days, the Mariners didn't have a good pitching staff. They were an expansion team. So if we didn't win 2 out of 3, Earl Weaver would get really pissed off. Or if we didn't sweep him, he'd get really pissed off. And, you know, he'd be yelling, "We're one of the worst teams in baseball. We can't win 2 out of 3. Yeah. But usually we did.
Yeah.
As far as hitting, I loved hitting in Fenway. I mean, the left field fence is so close. You reach out and touch it. You know, as I think during broadcast, and I see you could be late as a left-handed hitter and still be great, like Wade Boggs, just pepper the wall. Or as a right-handed hitter, if you pull the ball, I mean, you're golden.
Balls right there.
But yeah, you're good. You know, just as a switch hitter, they didn't have many lefties, so I got to hit left-handed.
I remember for years, my family had a summer home out in Maine. And one of the few channels we got on the TV, I think we had 5 channels total. It wasn't Nesson, but it was the Red Sox channel. And I remember they had a promotion like for kids 12 and under, hit a home run over the Green Monster and you could win some prizes. Sure enough, around 98, 99, they stopped holding that contest.
Because too many kids were doing it or what?
Yeah, exactly.
Now, as far as difficult to hit in, I always was a positive thinker. I didn't really think, but I can tell you, for some reason, I didn't hit all that well in Chicago. Maybe because they had some pretty good pitchers, and maybe because we went there early in the season, it was cold a lot of times.
Yeah,
and, you know, I felt like I'd hit anywhere, to be honest with you. I can remember early in my career being in the Astrodome. I thought it was really dark in there, and it was tougher to hit because it was hard to see the ball, and they had a lot of hard throwers. I felt like I hit every. I got my share of hits just about everywhere.
Yeah, you mentioned. I was actually very happy you mentioned the Kingdome. Have you seen the Secret Base 3+ hour documentary that is a cultural history of the Mariners?
No, I haven't seen that.
Oh, I'll send it to you. You'll really like it. Like a baseball lifer, I'll send that your way. You'll really enjoy it.
You know, the Mariners actually, years after I retired, they picked their all opponent team.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was myself and Jim Rice were the number one opponents. Evidently, we both wore out the Kingdome. So, yeah.
Were you and Jim Rice friends in your careers?
Well, you know, you talk to them before ball games. When you're playing the Red Sox, you're not friends with anybody on their team. You know?
Yeah.
If there was one team I really liked to beat, it was the Red Sox. But I'll tell you a quick story about Jim Rice. My middle son went to Clemson to play baseball.
Sure.
And I'd go down there, and there was a driving range, golf driving range, just outside of town. And I would go down there and hit balls.
Okay.
And one day the proprietor came up to me and says, "Hey, you're Kent Singleton." He says, "Your son's doing a good job playing for Clemson." And I said, "Yeah, thank you. He's going to be a good ball player." And you know, I'm hitting the golf ball. I'm hitting it pretty good. And he said, "You see those pine trees way back beyond the range there?" And I said, "Yeah, I see them." He said, "That's where Jim Rice hits them." I said, "Well, good for him." You know.
Yeah. Anyway, Ken Singleton, 50 plus years in the game, enjoying retirement right now, looking back on it all, just sum it up. We're going to give you the floor.
I would tell you this. It went really quick in terms of, you know, the 50 plus years. I got to meet a lot of good people in the game of baseball. You know, people I remain friends with. After I left Yes, I missed the people I work with there. When you work for Yes, everybody's at the top of their game. They know what they're doing. They put out a good product, probably the best of any regional sports network. Mm-hmm. I kind of miss my job. I will tell you what I don't miss. I don't miss the preparation. It takes hours to get ready for every game. I don't miss that. I don't miss getting into cities at 4 a.m. in the morning, traveling with a baseball team. I don't miss that. I enjoy more time with my family, my grandkids. My grandson's a heck of a baseball player and basketball player. He's only 13 years old, but his Little League team for the second year in a row got to the Final Four in New Jersey.
Wow.
And if they had won that, they had a chance to go to Little League World Series, but they got knocked out each year by bigger schools. Bigger city teams. They come from a small town in South Jersey. My son, who helped coach the team, said, at least we know we're the best team in South Jersey. I said, yeah, that's true. And my grandson this year, he started to hit home runs. He's starting to get bigger and stronger. He grew 4 inches this year.
Wow.
Well, he's going to be a really good player. You could see it at a young age in somebody. If he keeps his head on straight, which myself and his dad will probably keep him going in the right direction. His dad was a pro too.
Yeah.
Played today's organization. And I love watching my granddaughters play soccer. Mm-hmm. My daughter-in-law was a All-American soccer player. So between the two of them, we're going to have some good athletes. And there's nothing more fun as a grandparent. Hopefully you guys get there one day. To watching your grandkids just be successful. I mean, you don't have the pressure that you had with your own kids, you know.
Right.
But you have some. There's learning experiences you can hand out to them.
Last question I'll ask, because I can't believe we forgot this. Much like yourself, Ken, I'm an ambidextrous switch hitter.
Okay.
Will you be teaching the grandson how to switch hit?
I tried. He likes hitting left-handed better. He throws right-handed, but he hits left-handed. And I'm not going to force him, although I did tell him one day there's going to be somebody like Randy Johnson out on the mound. You're going to wish you were hitting right-handed. And he's still got time. You know, he did it for a little while. And my son said, you weren't at games, and he hit pretty well right-handed, but he just feels more comfortable hitting left-handed. And like I said, he started to hit home runs this year.
What inspired you to start switch hitting?
Oh, I started when I started hitting left-handed at first, but all the others were hitting right-handed. So I tried that and I could do both. And I didn't actually do it in games until I got to high school. Mm-hmm. And one day I was, you know, just fooling around before the game hitting left-handed. I was strictly a right-handed hitter up to that point.
Yeah.
And my coach said, you know, they're throwing a right-hander today. Why don't you hit left-handed? I said, okay. I hit two home runs that day. He said,
there you go.
You're a switch hitter now. And from that point on, the scouts just gravitated towards me. So
I had to force my parents and my coaches to sort of accept that I was switch hitting, because my two favorite players growing up, Ken Griffey Jr. for the swagger, but I also was also a big fan of Greg Jeffries, just because watching him with the Mets, like this, I'm like 5-6 years old. I'm just watching him and I see him and I go, this is a guy who's not a great power hitter. But he's got that bulldog mentality where he's like, okay, I'm going up to bat. The one thing I'm not going to do is strike out.
Well, he'd certainly be in a different category than hitters nowadays.
Yeah.
But one thing to me is it's just way too many strikeouts. That's been a problem for the Yankees the last – and not only them, but every team. Yeah. I mean, I think for the last 10 years or so, the major league strikeout totals are going up every year. Yeah. Now, couple of years of home runs have gone up too. I mean, but there are no hitters like Wade Boggs or Tony Gwynn around anymore. There's not many of them. All these guys are just trying to launch. And I slowly but surely, I think it's going to come back the other way. and you're going to get more guys. I think one thing you're seeing more recently, the last couple of years, stolen bases are starting to come back.
Yes, absolutely.
And they're really going to come back now that they're making the bases bigger and pitchers can't throw over 100 times. You know, now there's going to be more action in the game, and you're going to see
– not having the ship, you're going to see more contact hitting just by default. Oh,
yeah. And the hitters are going to benefit. Yeah. And Mark Teixeira, you know, any left-hand – you name any left-handed hitter, a good left – how many rockets did they hit in the short right field that were turned into outs? I think they got to get more action into the game. They got to get more balls put in play, and I think that that's going to help.
You know, it's funny because, as Josh mentioned earlier, I was a hitting coach for a while at a place here in Pennsylvania where a local made it to the major leagues, and he plays for the Diamondbacks right now. And it's always interesting hearing his perspective in the offseason when he comes back and, like, just watching his preparation and the way his process works in the offseason, but then recognizing – man, he's facing pitchers who have ungodly stuff, like 95-mile-an-hour sliders and all that kind of stuff. And I feel like also a lot of the times the pitchers themselves don't know where it's going. So,
yeah, Alex, I will tell you that there are definitely more hard throwers in the game than when I was playing. There's definitely more. Yeah. There's a lot of guys who throw like Nolan Ryan now, a lot of them. And to me, this launch angle stuff where everybody's trying to lift up and hit the ball out of – that means you can't hit a high fastball. You can't hit it. You're going to swing right through it. And most of the swings and misses are on that pitch just around the letters or a little higher, where it looks good to the hitter because it's closest to their eyes and they see it well, and they swing, they can't hit it because they're lifting up with their swings. It can't be done. That's why I say they got to get away from this launch angle thing and bring back hitting. I mean, to me, if the ball was too hard to reach and hit, that means it was going to be a ball. You know, you can't hit that. You know, you're not going to hit it hard. So I want to go the other way. I think I was a hitter that was in between, like Larry Doby said. You could hit home runs, but you also could hit for average. Mm-hmm. And I drew a lot of walks, so that jacked my on-base percentage up. So I want hitters like that.
It would have been really interesting if someone had gone to like Jim Palmer and said, throw a fastball, letter high.
Uh-huh.
You'll probably be like, what are you talking about? That ball is going to get destroyed. But nowadays, exactly. Pitchers are encouraged to do that because.
Yeah, because they're all throwing 95 to 100. And, you know, Jim pretty well. And he had a pretty good high, hard one at times. But he also knew how to pitch. And he knew how to change speeds. He had a good slow curveball. He could dot his fastball. He had a good slider. He just knew how to pitch, and it just wasn't trying to throw the ball by people. You know, they're trying to go for soft contact. They're trying to get that ground ball for the double play. You know, just things like that. It's the game has changed a lot. If you had players from 100 years ago come watch a game nowadays, what the starting pitcher? It's only the sixth inning. Where do you go? Yeah. Or who's this guy – coming in the ninth inning just to throw one inning? Or who's this designated hitter guy, you know, or things like that. So it makes you wonder if we could go back or go ahead 100 years from now and watch baseball, how much is it going to change 100 years from now?
Yeah.
Of course, we won't get the opportunity, but just the game's going to evolve, and hopefully in a good way.
I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the questions I did want to ask, and I wasn't sure if we're going to have time to, is just like with your extensive history with the game, just watching it evolve in the way it has. So, yeah, I thought you brought up some really good points there for sure. One comment I'm going to make when you were talking about your switch hitting and when you started it, Ken, it's not supposed to be that easy. Come on. That's not fair.
It's twice as much work, Alex. You're right. But I will say this, if the whole idea to make money in the big leagues is the play.
Yeah.
And if you're a switch hitter and you're good at it, you can play every single day. Mm-hmm. And I got to play with Eddie Murray batting behind me. And I will say this, I think we're the best switch hitting duo in the history of the game. And
are you and Eddie still in touch?
Oh, yeah. You know, in fact, Christmas is coming up. I'll probably call him, or he's in California. He's got bad knees now, so he doesn't play golf like the rest of us. So, but, you know, he's played in my tournament a couple of times, but I think now his knees are bothering him too much.
Yeah, he's definitely, like, Eddie Murray definitely looks like someone who, great teammate, not someone you messed with ever.
I got some good Eddie Murray stories. We were playing in Japan, and a pitcher threw at him. Eddie hit 10 home runs in 2 weeks down there, playing in Japan.
Did you meet Sadaharu Oh while you were there?
Yeah, I saw Oh. He didn't play. He was managing the other team.
Right.
I guess one of these Japanese pitchers got tired of Eddie hitting home runs against, and he threw one right at Eddie's ear and knocked him down. His helmet went flying. The bat went flying. Eddie got up, brushed himself off, stared at the pitcher, just stared right at him, and hit the next pitch out of the stadium.
Wow.
Measured it at 520 feet. And
520.
It hit and rolled downhill onto the shoreline of a lake.
Oh, my God.
And we're yelling at the Japanese pitcher, throw at me, throw at me. Understand what we were saying, but they had such a stunned look on their faces, like we poked the bear and the bear just got us all. I mean, I'd never seen a comeback like that by any hitter. Just hit it completely out of the stadium.
That we've been having a great talk with Ken Singleton. I could talk to you for hours upon hours more. We'll definitely need to have you back on because, like, stories for days.
Pleasure, Josh. Alex, my pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us. And, folks, you can find Ken, you got anything you want to plug?
I'm with a foundation that helps kids with dealing with cancer and their families. It's called the Cool Kids Campaign.
Okay.
And if you go to coolkidscampaign.org, you can see how you can donate. I have my golf tournament, 16 years of doing that. Things that we do for the kids and their families, all our services are free for them. We give them, we have a newsletter that we send nationwide to kids who are in hospitals, gift baskets, Christmas parties, birthday parties. All these services are free. We have a parents' night where we'll watch the kids at our clubhouse. We'll, you know, get the movies to watch while the parents go out on a date. You can imagine how families are dealing with a child that has cancer. And unfortunately, some of these kids don't make it, but a lot of them do. And we try and make it easier on them. So coolkidscampaign.org. All the donations are appreciated. And we have several golf tournaments during the year all over the country. Mike Ruzioni has one in Boston.
There you go.
The Olympic speed skater has one in North Carolina. And we're trying to get one organized for Dennis Martinez in Florida. And I have mine here in Maryland. And we're trying to get some others organized around the country. So if you can help kids and their families with cancer, it's a great cause.
That would be the Cool Kids Campaign. Ken Singleton has been here on Bleacher Creatures, episode number 150. Ken, thanks so much for your time. This is a pleasure.
Josh, Alex, take care. Have good holidays, guys.
You too.